Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Book Network, Science and Technology and Societies. I'm Patrick Slaney, and today I'm talking to Lawrence Bush, the author of Standards, Recipes for Reality. So as Lawrence reminds us, standards are all around us, governing things like seating arrangements, medicine, experimental objects and subjects, and even romance novels in his book. In Standards, Recipes for Reality, Bush provides a wide-ranging and accessible analysis of the ways that standards structure the world. More than simply providing a typology of standards, Bush shows the ways that the impetus to standardization and standardized differentiation have transformed as part of political and historical changes. Under contemporary neoliberalism, the drive to standardization has generated sophisticated relationships between standards, certified professional bodies, and accrediting agencies, relationships that Bush provides the resources for thinking about politically. Using plenty of accessible and insightful examples, and clearly in contact with much of the literature in science and technology studies, Bush's book is a great read and a great entry into thinking about technoscience, power, and neoliberalism. Give it a read. Hi, Larry.
Hi there. How are you today?
I'm very good. Welcome to the New Books Network for Science, Technology, and Society.
Thank you.
We're talking today about your book, Standards, Recipes for Reality. But before we get to the book, why don't you tell me a little bit about sort of who you are and how you came to think about this stuff.
Okay. I'm a professor on the faculty at Michigan State University in the sociology department. My background is in sociology, history, and economics. And I sort of fell into this. I was doing some STS-type work about roughly 15 years ago with a graduate student. We were wandering around in canola fields in Canada and in Saskatchewan, and we would go and ask people about the production of canola seed and canola as grain and canola as cooking oil and so on, and invariably people would say, well, you know, we have to do this according to the standards that are in place. And what we began to realize as we did more and more research is that this was a product that literally would not exist were it not for, as I recollect, roughly about 35 different kinds of standards. And what we began to realize was that this whole area of standards production, standards enforcement, standards modification was largely undeveloped as a field of study, although you could find huge amounts of literature about any particular kind of technical or other standard, that you couldn't find any, shall we say, overview of what standards were, why you needed them, what they did, what they didn't do, and so on. And so for most of the last 15 years, I've been involved in something which is now called the Center for the Study of Standards and Society. And we've done, probably more than a dozen research projects on various kinds of standards in various different fields. Initially starting with standards in the food and agricultural sector, because that's the area that I was most familiar with, but more recently branching out into areas like nanotechnologies and other areas. And a few years ago, a colleague of mine said, you know, you really ought to write a general book on this subject. And after he pushed that about five or six times, he finally convinced me that indeed there was a a need for and a space for such a book, and that's what we're talking about today.
Right. So you sort of came to science, technology, and society a little bit more recently, right? You weren't trained as a sociologist of science, were you?
Well, there were very few programs when I mean, right. I'm 67. There weren't very many programs in that. I went to graduate school at Cornell, where there was a small STS program, and I knew some of the people in it, but it was just a program. It wasn't a department. You couldn't get a degree in it. It was just a handful of courses.
Yeah.
So, yes, like most people my age who are into STS stuff, we got into it by falling into it rather than making a conscious decision early on in our careers.
I like the way in the book, actually, that you're very kind of aware of the sort of the theoretical discussions going on in the STS literature and the sociology of science literature, but you make them very accessible. So I think that was a real achievement on your part. Why don't we get right to the book? You start the book with, you know, fantastic examples of how pervasive and ubiquitous standards and standardized things are around us. And to take the subtitle of your book seriously, Recipes for Reality, why do you think it's so important to take standards as constitutive of reality? Why is it important to recognize their role?
Well, because I think that the tendency on the part of both the general public and even many practitioners who are in the business of producing or enforcing standards see standards as rather tedious, boring, technical things. And what I wanted to do in this book is to show that while you certainly can view them that way if you want to, in fact, these are things that are reality creating. So, for example, you might say that standards as well as customary practices of various sorts, like shaking hands or saying, hello, how are you, and legal frameworks, all constitute a fairly large portion of our world. And I mean constitute in the literal sense. If you wish, they're means by which we are governed.
Mm-hmm.
And so, for example, when I enter a classroom or a doctor's office, I usually don't need to worry about whether the seat that I'm sitting in is going to hold my weight, since it's been designed according to standards for precisely that purpose. And conversely, some standards restrict at least some of us from doing things we would like to do. So, for example, I'm 6 feet tall. Sitting in a coach seat on a long flight is tolerable, but not something I really enjoy. On the other hand, if I was 6'10", there'd be literally no place for me to put my legs because the space between the seats has been standardized for people who are of, quote, average, mm-hmm. unquote, height.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. To flip that around, though, I mean, one of the other things I think that you point out is, and that you just sort of mentioned, is that there hasn't been a book about standards, and this is an understudied topic. And I wonder if part of that is because standards are actually quite hard to talk about. What makes them hard to talk about or to think about?
In one of the few books, an edited book by Martha Lampland and Susan Lee Starr that came out a few years ago, one of the things they talk about is precisely how standards are forms of infrastructure. They're things that allow one to get on with the business at hand. They're very rarely, for most people, the actual business at hand. So, as I said, you know, if I get on an airplane, I go and I find a seat, I sit on the seat, and I don't pay any attention to the literally tens of thousands of standards that were necessary to make that airplane flyable. And including, of course, standards for the seat itself and how far back it should go and how the seat belt should be placed and how much space between the seats and hundreds of other technical things there that someone has decided upon. Usually it would take quite a bit of effort to find out who that someone was, but clearly someone did. And those things shape almost everything we do in modern societies.
So they're invisible pretty much until sort of we have a problem with them, right? And it's only then that we think about them a lot of the times, it seems like.
That's right. If I sit on a chair and the chair starts to fall apart, I very quickly try and get up and regain my balance rather than falling on the floor. And the first thing I do is look at the chair and try to figure out, gee, why did this chair fall apart?
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's when things go wrong that standards become noticeable. Yeah. As long as things run the way they're supposed to, we don't pay any attention to them.
One of the things that you do in the book is sort of, I think, methodologically refuse to distinguish between standards for people and standards for things. And this resonates with a lot of sort of the approaches in the STS literature. But why do you think, I mean, what's the benefit of that kind of analytical approach?
Well, if you look historically, you can actually see two, shall we say, groups of people involved in standards production and maintenance and enforcement. You have people who are involved in, say, standards for healthcare and standards for education on the one hand, which are almost always about standards for people. Mm-hmm. And you have others who are interested in standards for screw threads or for USB ports or for other mechanical objects.
Right.
And the assumption is these things don't have anything to do with each other.
Yeah.
But the point that I try to emphasize here is that you can't have standards for things without standards for people and vice versa. So, for example, standards for cell phones require that the people who make them meet certain standards. If you don't meet those standards in making the phones, then the phones don't work. And they also require the people who use them to meet other standards. So, for example, if I was handicapped in the sense that my fingers didn't work properly, I would have a great deal of difficulty in using most of the cell phones that are out there. The assumption is users are able to do that. Moreover, if I hit the buttons in the wrong order, the cell phone won't work for me. I must conform to the standard that's out there. So you can conceptually sort out the standards for things and separate them from those from people, but you can't do it in practice.
Yeah. Do you remember the, I think one of the recent iterations of the iPhone had this issue with, calls getting dropped because of where people were holding the iPhone. And this was a sort of a clear case where, you know, people, I think users expected the object to be standardized in a way that they could use it. But sort of Steve Jobs as an Apple's response was, no, I think you guys should just change how you standardly use the cell phone so that you don't get this dropping all the time.
Sure, sure. Yeah. And I mean, obviously, if you've made several million of these, you don't want to say, okay, we'll just throw those away and start all over again. Yeah. You know, there's a substantial expense in doing that. So you try to convince people that they should change their behavior. And, of course, you know, as somebody who grew up before computers were around, personal computers, when I first got a personal computer, I couldn't type. Somebody dumped it in my office, and it sat there for about a month before I went to look at it. And, of course, the first thing I realized, at least now in retrospect, I didn't realize at the time, is I had to rethink the way I did things in order to do that. One of the problems we used to have back in the mid-'80s was secretaries who were using computers and previously had used typewriters would put hard returns in at the end of every line.
Yeah.
And, of course, this created documents that were unreadable.
Yeah.
But they didn't know that because they had learned a completely different standard than one associated with a manual typewriter.
Right. Yeah. So one of the, I think, most evocative ways that you talk about the way that standards constitute reality and the way that they sort of bring together what I think of as the natural and the normative or the social and the natural, is you talk about, you say that standards make metaphors real. Can you tell me a little bit about what you meant by that?
Well, probably the best way to do that is to just give you a simple example.
Okay.
If you take a scale in a supermarket where you might have meat weighed,
mm-hmm.
The metaphor that is implicit there is that the weight of the meat is the same as the weight that's shown on the scale.
Yes.
That's what the metaphor is. But it's only true if that scale is regularly checked to ensure that the metaphor holds.
Yeah.
Because scales get out of balance.
Yeah.
Even the best scales get out of balance.
Yeah.
And so there's a whole elaborate system of people and certificates and special weights that are moved literally around the world to check to see that scales maintain within certain limits the weights that they're supposed to have. And that's also, of course, why you know, if we were weighing diamonds, we wouldn't want to use that scale in the supermarket to weigh the diamonds. And we probably, for that matter, would find the precision given in the diamond scale rather useless in weighing meat. But these are metaphors that are made real. You're saying this is equal to that, or is right. the same as that,
yeah.
and you're demonstrating that indeed it is.
Yeah, so it's about this power of, I guess, identification, and making alike things, or sort of unalike things, actually seem alike, or to use the term that I think you use, commensurable, that I think is really revealing. The power of these things, and the thing that drives the most obvious thing that to me that's crazy that people have standardized and sort of have clearly made real is credit scores, right? That you can like suddenly you can take someone's life history and turn it into a number, and that is comparable to everybody else's numbers, and it has like clear financial and like sort of lifestyle consequences, right?
Absolutely, and you could say the same thing about the use of citation counts in evaluating faculty members at universities, at research universities. It these things become real by virtue of producing the numbers.
Yeah.
And the whether the metaphor holds on those things is actually a much more difficult question to answer than it is in the case of, say, the scale with the meat, because we can have an independent way of checking that the scale works properly. Whereas in the case of those credit scores, they're largely black boxed. You can't tell what's going on behind the scenes. No one's going to give you the formula that's used to produce those. In fact, it's likely a trade secret.
Yeah, they're proprietary often, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. One of the themes, I mean, and to return to something we've already sort of touched on, one of the themes is that standards affect what we think about and what we don't think about. And I think this addresses kind of the broader political engagement of your book, because you actually end the book with a quote, or very close to the end. You introduce the conclusion with a quote by Hayek, right? Where Hayek is talking about, it's in The Road to Serfdom, so, and he's talking about the price system, and he likes it because it advances civilization by extending the number of important operations we can perform without thinking about them. Standards seem to do the same thing, right? Why is it important not to have to think?
Well, we're all creatures of habit. And there's a wonderful little book that was written by William James just about a century ago mm-hmm. called Habit. Mm-hmm. And what James points out is that what habits allow us to do is to focus our attention on what is of concern at the moment rather than having to think about all the things we do. So, for example, a very somewhat silly example, if I had to think mm-hmm. about walking,
mm-hmm.
I would spend all my time thinking when I was walking, all of my energy would be absorbed with trying to think about, well, now I have to raise my left foot and move it slightly forward and then put it down on the ground and then pick up the right foot and move it slowly forward and put it down on the ground. And walking would become a virtually impossible task. On a more serious note, by the way, I should note that is serious for people, for example, who for one reason or another lost the ability to walk and have to learn how to do it all over again.
Yeah.
This is a very difficult task
yeah.
until you can make it habitual.
Yeah.
But we're habitual in other ways as well. So, for example, when I get up in the morning on a work day,
yeah.
I get up at the same time each day. Alarm yeah. clock, which is standardized, goes off and it says it's time to get up. And I follow a routine. I take off my pajamas, I go in the shower, I shave, and so on. Now, standards do the same kind of thing on a social or societal level. That is to say, they make it possible for us to forget all the work that goes into standardizing things and people's behavior. So when my car has a flat tire and I go to the garage to get it fixed, I don't have to say to myself now, gee, do the people in this garage have the right tools? Do they have the right equipment? Do they have the right skills? Because, in fact, when I go there, excuse me, before I go, I already know that these folks have that equipment and tools. that'll allow them to remove the wheel, to take the tire off the wheel, and to repair it. I also know those people that work there are properly trained. They're even perhaps certified to follow standard procedures in changing tires. Mm-hmm. And there, of course, are hundreds of standards involved in this process that are essentially invisible to me, in addition to the ones I just mentioned. Standards about the building. I don't have to worry when I go into the garage there that the building's going to fall down on top of me because it wasn't made to meet building codes. I don't have to worry that I'm going to fall into a hole on the floor because there's a big sign there that says the work area is not a place where customers are allowed. And a whole variety of standards of that sort that make this an orderly and straightforward process. Mm-hmm. And I think that's true for all standards. They mm-hmm. they allow us to think about and act in other ways and not have to worry about those things unless, as you mentioned earlier, for one reason or another, the standard or standards break down.
Yeah. And I think this is one of the ways that they're so powerful and that power is invisible, right? Because there, like you said, there's a huge amount of social work and regimentation that is required in anything like repairing or changing a car's tire or repairing a car. But one of the things that you do argue is that the way that we think about standardized things has changed. Right? And the way that we think about standards and people in particular has changed. So that there's this change from a relationship, from thinking about trustworthiness to thinking about to a standardized world being one in which we just rely on sort of predictability. Can you say a little bit about what that's about?
Well, yeah, there's two ways of thinking about the term trust.
Okay.
At least two ways, perhaps others. But one way is to think of trust as trustworthiness. So, uh-huh. For example, that is to say, someone who is trustworthy is literally worthy of my trust.
Mm-hmm.
My wife is worthy of, she's trustworthy. She's worthy of my trust. I know that regardless of what happens to me, I know with enormous confidence that she's going to take care of me. She's going to do the right thing.
Yeah.
It's not to say she can't make mistakes, but that I can trust that regardless of what happens, she's going to be there and be trustworthy.
Right.
You could probably say something close to that with a little bit more in the way of limitation, about a dog. One of the reasons they talk about dogs, and I'm not, you know, not suggesting my wife is to be directly equated with dogs, but rather one of the reasons why this notion dog is man's best friend, is because dogs become attached to people. And there are thousands of stories of dogs engaging in behavior that's really quite extraordinary for a canine when something happens to their master.
Right.
Okay? Now, contrary to that, when we're talking generally about things, things can be trusted. So when I'm going to work in the morning, and I live a fair distance from the university where I work, I get in the car, I get out on the superhighway, and I go about 70 miles an hour all the way there.
Okay.
And I don't worry that, oh my gosh, you know, the car's going to fall apart. It's going to, a wheel's going to fall off. It's going to run off the road. Now, of course, all of those things could happen.
Yes.
But the point is that the car that I have is a relatively new model built by a well-known manufacturer, and it's one that is known as a reliable vehicle that I can trust to get me there. Okay?
Yeah.
There obviously are other vehicles that you probably wouldn't want to trust at that speed or at any great distance. Okay?
Yeah.
But those are the world is made up of many, many things in which we can trust that aren't trustworthy.
Right.
In the same sense. That is to say, we can trust that Stalin was an SOB and did very nasty things. And if somebody told me today, well, you know, in addition to all those people you know who were in the gulag, there were 50,000 more over there, I wouldn't be terribly surprised.
Right.
Okay? So I can trust Stalin in that sense. But Stalin certainly wasn't trustworthy In fact, he was known as somebody who could turn on his friends almost in an instant if he felt threatened.
Right.
Okay, so I think the key here is that standards produce trust in that mechanical sense. They don't produce trustworthiness. Okay, and I think that's an important thing to understand about standards. We have to rely on standards. We can't do without them.
Yeah.
But they don't produce trustworthiness. They produce trust only in the sense of reliability and consistency.
Yeah.
And you see this, I mean, I think one of the things that's, I mean, there's a historical sweep to your story, and I think we'll talk about that in a second, but I think one of the big historical changes you want to point to is the way that, you know, perhaps in the past, perhaps in a mythical past, we had all these relationships with people that were based, or that in which trustworthiness was sort of the key epistemic or credibility relationships that existed between them. And we're increasingly surrounded by relationships with other people in which we don't think about their trustworthiness. We think about them in this mechanical, predictable way.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. If we were living, say, a century and a half ago, and we went into the local general store,
yeah,
we would probably know that person by name.
Yeah.
That person would probably have extended us credit if we were a little short on cash that week. That person might have just given us a little extra just because he or she wanted to be nice.
Yeah.
In contrast, today, when I go into the supermarket, I don't even have to pay any. In fact, I don't even have to go past a cashier. I can go to one of these checkout machines,
yeah,
and I don't have to see anyone while I'm in the supermarket, even though the supermarket is crowded.
Yeah.
Right? So what there we have trust. I trust that the other people in the supermarket aren't going to likely be to want to rob me. I trust that the people have stocked the shelves with products that I will recognize and that they haven't stuffed poison in the cereal box, and I trust that the machine that checks me out of the supermarket is reading the right prices. Okay, but there's no trustworthiness in that at all. It's strictly a mechanical kind of trust.
Yeah, and I guess so. This brings to light kind of a difference, and that is this. I mean, I guess when I have a relationship of trustworthiness with people, I think often it's because I recognize some kind of loyalty between them and I, or some commonality of interest. Like, I genuinely believe that they have my interest at heart, right? And I don't really believe that necessarily of grocery stores or the cereal producer. I don't believe that they don't, you know, put rat poison into the food because they have my best interest at heart. I think they do that because there's institutional checks on them, and there would be bad consequences for them if they did that.
I think that's absolutely correct. I think in fact, in one of my other hats, I've done research on supermarkets.
Okay.
And one of the jokes that I tell to my economist friends,
yeah,
is that what supermarkets desperately want is to be loved. And the problem, of course, is that the way that supermarkets are set up makes having a loving relationship extremely difficult. But if you look at the kind of advertising,
right,
as well as store arrangements in supermarkets, supermarkets work very, very hard to give one the illusion of trustworthiness, of loyalty, of more than mere reliability.
Yeah.
And the only ones that really succeed in this are the very, very upscale supermarkets, which can afford to have sufficient staff relative to consumers, that indeed personal relationships can be developed.
Yeah.
But most of us can't afford to shop in those places.
No, yeah. So there's a class, there's certain classes that get access to trustworthiness and others don't, sort of. This is one thing that you bring up as well.
Sure, sure. I mean, if you are wealthy enough to have your personal concierge,
yeah,
you can be assured that person is going to buy just the present that your wife or girlfriend or daughter or whomever would like.
Yeah.
But you have a one-on-one relationship with that person.
Yeah. I think the other place this happens is in. I mean, have you seen evidence of this happening in places where, you know, there's a very strong, I guess, transition to a mechanical form of objectivity. So when I'm thinking about medicine, right, because, like, your relationship with your doctor is one in which you kind of have to have a trustworthy relationship, but at the same time, there's an incredible amount of standardization acting both upon the doctor and upon the things that the doctor is prescribing to you, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. But I think one of the things that's very clear in the medical literature is that if you remove the trustworthiness,
right,
the whole relationship falls apart. That while it's certainly true that that medicine requires both that kind of mechanical trust in all the enormous amounts of gadgetry that medicine uses these days, some with extraordinary success, I should add. But at the same time, if you don't have that confidence that this person has my interests at heart and isn't just doing this in a mechanical way, you're likely to be at the very least petrified of what's going to happen to you. And I would argue that such relationships are not good relationships for the medical world. Those are medical relations, relations with lawyers, relations with teachers, for that matter. These tend to be relationships which need to have a very personal element to them. And if they're purely mechanical, there's a tremendous amount that gets lost.
Yeah. So it's interesting to me that so often I've seen when people are dissatisfied with these kind of relationships with teachers or doctors, in which, you know, they don't feel like they're trustworthy or that they have their interests at heart. There's this, people try and attempt to have a recourse to mechanical modes of credibility or sort of a predictability, as though thinking that imposing that would would sort of guarantee that this the relationship would be better.
Well, it may not make it better, but it maybe perhaps limits the harm that could be done.
Yeah.
It's one of the reasons why we have very detailed legal frameworks for approval of medical equipment and drugs.
Right.
One of the reasons why we have standards of good medical practice, and the surgeon who operates on you in a non-standard way and causes harm is liable in court for not using good medical practice, good surgical practices.
Yeah, for sure. But I wonder, I mean, so I've heard that there's sort of a conflict between, I mean, I think those standards set up some sort of a minimum criteria, but there is also conflict between things like evidence-based medicine and professional discernment, right? Or professional discretion.
Perhaps a little bit less there, because I think one thing about evidence-based medicine is that it doesn't say what evidence you use. It doesn't say how you should interpret that evidence. It simply says, don't just do it because it's been done in the past. So if leeches seem to eliminate disease because we've done it in the past, that's not a really good idea to continue to do that. Better find some evidence that leeches are a good thing to use.
And I guess just having been used in the past does not count as evidence in this case.
Okay.
Let's get to the past, because I think you do, I mean, like I said, there's this historical narrative and there's this story about forces that are pushing both towards standardization and away from destandardization that have their peaks at different sort of historical moments. One of the sort of key time periods is the turn of the 20th century, it seems like. Sort of in the late 19th century, there's all these international scientific organizations that are getting together and agreeing upon international standards. I think, is it in 1901 that the United Kingdom sets up its standard bureau? I think it's 1903.
Yes, that's right.
It's 1903 that in the United States, the National Bureau of Standards is founded. Mm-hmm. So why is sort of this long turn of the 20th century, as some historians like to call it, such a crucial period?
Well, I think, as you suggest, standards have been around for a very, very long time. Standards for things like bricks.
Yeah.
You can look at the temples of Babylon, and they were made of very highly standardized bricks.
Okay.
But these were exceptions, the things that were standardized. What I think happens in the late 19th century, and I think arguably as a growth on the one hand of the on the one hand of a growth of technoscience, and on the other hand of long distance trade in industrial objects, Remember, this is also the time when the steamship becomes available. So trading heavy things over long distances becomes a lot cheaper, than it had been prior to that. When this becomes possible, it becomes obvious to many people that standards are needed.
Okay.
Things that would be only done close to home might have a very local standard. During the entire Middle Ages, for example, there were thousands of local standards for bushels, for example. But each little village had its own standard.
Well,
once trade and science become fairly commonplace in the Western world, especially, the need for standards that go beyond a little village become critical. And as a result of that, you see an explosion of standards, as well as books and articles published about the benefits of standards and standardization, starting roughly in the late 19th century. As an example, consider railways.
Yes.
When railways were first built, the belief, which to our eyes seems almost humorous, the belief was that that railways would merely bring goods to the nearest port or canal, where they would be transferred onto a ship and go the rest of the way. As railways were developed, it became clear that they could actually replace many river ports and canals. For a couple of years, I lived in Lancaster in England.
Okay.
And there's a canal that goes through Lancaster, and it was one of the very last canals built. By the time it was completed, it was almost useless. And the reason it was useless was because the railways came.
Just made it obsolete.
And the railways, pardon?
They just made it obsolete.
That's right. They made it obsolete. It allows goods to be moved at a much higher speed, over much longer distances, with a lot less in the way of transshipment, where you had to unload and load things constantly.
Right.
Now, as the railroads were connected, of course, they discovered immediately that you had different gauges of track, as well as different ways of building the track beds.
Yeah.
And these hampered linking the railroads. Right. So in Europe, but also in the United States, for example, in the U.S., it was the Transcontinental Railroad that was built to a gauge that became the standard gauge over the next half century, making a national rail system in the United States possible. Prior to that, there were dozens of gauges.
Yeah.
So you couldn't have a national system. But the very fact that you now had a line that went all the way across the country meant that all the railroads wanted to connect to that line. And they wanted to do it in a way that didn't involve having to empty the cars on one track and put them on another track. And that meant change the gauge. And so what you find at that period is this incredible enthusiasm for standardization. It was going to be the solution to all kinds of problems. It was going to, and the notion was that there was a best way to do everything. You also see this in somewhat later, in around 1911, if my memory serves me correctly, with
Frederick Winslow Taylor.
Taylor's notion that you could measure work and come up with the single best way to standardize all work.
Yeah, his one best way.
That's right.
Yeah. So there's something about just this increase in scale that everything has at that time period, kind of as a consequence of industrialization, I guess. But the appeal of this, it seems like it also crosses ideology and politics, so that you have people enthusiastic about standardization, you know, on the left and on the right, and even in sort of in communist countries, right?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Lenin was a great fan of Taylor.
Yes.
He also made the line that, socialism was merely capitalism made to serve the people. So for Lenin, this wasn't terribly surprising. You just took everything capitalism had and you had it. Instead of private ownership, we'll have state ownership. And there it is. All the problems are solved.
Right.
In retrospect, this seems rather naive, but of course, only in retrospect.
Yeah. I think, Stalin is also a huge fan of Ford. And I think there's some quote somewhere where he says something like Soviet communism is Fordism plus electrification.
I believe that's right.
And that's like just sort of how profound their faith is in.
And Stalin also bought a complete Ford plant from Ford that was obsolete to make vehicles that were essentially completely identical to the Fords in the Soviet Union.
Yeah. So at the same time as you have kind of this huge momentum towards standardization, you also have kind of resistances to standardization that I think you sort of identify as being more historically evident slightly later. So what is driving towards what's driving, I guess, social life towards non-standardization, or what makes standardization difficult, or on the one hand, and then on the other hand, like what you call standardized differentiation, right?
Okay. Well, first of all, I think it's important to say that standardization worked very well and continues to work very well for some products and processes.
Right.
And it would be a mistake to ignore that. There are still new forms of standardization that emerge even today. So, for example, I mentioned USB ports earlier. Every computer you buy has got a USB port on it. Doesn't make any difference what brand, what make, what model, all have USB ports. And that's necessary to the rest of the infrastructure. The same would go for shipping containers.
Yes.
Shipping containers now are standardized worldwide.
Yeah.
They're all identical within certain parameters.
Yeah.
If it weren't for that, the cost of imported goods would be much higher than it is.
You have a fantastic analysis of shipping containers and the way they change everything, including sort of packaging.
Absolutely.
In the book.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, it seems to me that there's an interesting thing about standardization, using standards to standardize. And that is that on the one hand, it's very useful to monopolies.
Yes.
Because it means that you get the most efficient production. You figure out what's going to be most efficient for you as a monopoly, and that's what you do.
Yeah.
And at the same time, it encourages the formation of monopolies because it reduces the cost of production in a way that makes competition solely price competition.
Right.
And since competition becomes solely price competition, you wind up with a few large firms that basically control every industry. And this is what the turn of the century trust busting movement was all about.
Right.
It was with a concern that too much power was getting tied up in a handful of firms owned by a very small number of people, and that this was not good for the economy. Because, of course, once you have that kind of monopolization, these folks could also set their own prices.
And they routinely did.
And they routinely
supposedly
did.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It was not for no reason that they were called the robber barons.
Right.
In contrast to that, what I call standardized differentiation, and let me explain briefly that what I mean by that is not a reversion to craft production, where everything is different,
right,
but rather having products that are differentiated and standardized at the same time. And the examples I use would be Heinz's 57 varieties of pickles and General Motors' segmentation of the auto market. These were two early and very successful attempts at standardized differentiation, and they allowed competition on multiple dimensions. This included, for example, numerous product qualities, the packaging of the product, the warranties that you might give for the product. In the case of automobiles, obviously, you might give a 1 or a 3 year warranty. In the case of the pickles, you might give a money back warranty. And it also allows markets then to be differentiated in the sense of being sliced into ever smaller pieces catering to different consumers. So even as introductory economics textbooks continue to talk about the market, this idealized world in which there is almost entirely price competition and no other kind, in fact, the global economy is largely based on standardized differentiation, with the exception of, shall we say, basic commodities. And in fact, you have somebody like Jeffrey Immelt, the CEO of General Electric, coming out some years ago and saying the reason why you want to innovate is to avoid commodity hell. In other words, you don't want to have a product that's identical to the one that other company is selling.
Right.
And I think that's the reason why you see this shift towards standardized differentiation. It's a real fear on the part of companies that price competition will drive most of them out of business. and essentially reduce profits to near zero.
So this is this drive basically from within capital that, you know, market segmentation is just much more profitable than thoroughgoing standardization.
Sure. If I want to buy a car, for example, yeah. or for that matter, if even I want to buy a toaster, there are hundreds of models and makes.
Yeah.
And while I can compare solely on price, they're not really comparable by price. I can't compare a Yugo with a high-end Mercedes. Obviously the Yugo is going to be a lot cheaper, but it's also not the same car. It's not the same product.
Right. You also tell this great story about going to a sorghum market in the Sudan, and about the difficulty there of standardizing. And I guess I think the broader lesson is that there's a lot of, there can be inherent, we can think things are standardizable, and actually there's a lot of resistance from the stuff itself and from the circumstances of the people interested in standardizing to standardize. Can you say a little bit about that?
Well, the market that I was talking about just happened to be one that stuck in my head.
Okay.
I've spent a lot of my career wandering around various parts of the world and observing things in farmers' fields and at markets.
Yeah.
And I think the thing about that particular market was the place where it hit me that you had several hundred people in that marketplace. All of them were selling grain sorghum. It was of various colors. Some of it was very clean. Some of it was obviously quite dirty. Some of it was clearly somewhat insect infected. Some of it obviously had some sort of plant disease on the kernels. And then on top of that, each person in the market had some sort of big enameled bowl full of sorghum in which they would scoop sorghum out of. And they used tin cans
yep.
of various sizes and shapes to scoop the sorghum out.
Yeah.
And some of them sold level tin can fulls, some rounded tin can fulls, and some heaping tin can fulls. Now, you could ask, and a hypothetical, very naive economist might walk into that marketplace and say, well, what's the price of sorghum? And it would be extremely difficult to figure out what the price of sorghum was, because right. here you have a case where, other than the currency, almost everything in the market was unstandardized.
Right.
And so the idea of talking about the market price
right.
was almost meaningless.
Right.
And I think what that suggests is that modern markets have at least four properties that are standardized. And those are the quality of the item that's being sold.
Right.
A measure of quantity that is standardized.
Right.
Prices that are standardized, that is to say, the price is in the form of a money price.
Yep. That's,
and I'm sorry, go ahead.
That's the same across the board.
Absolutely. And the currency is standardized yep. in the sense that it's not inflating at the rate of 50% a day.
Right.
As, of course, has been a problem in many parts of the world at many
right.
times.
Right.
So without those four things being standardized, what we understand as the market price is essentially, I think, essentially impossible to calculate.
Right. And I guess I think that the Sudan, this market example is kind of extreme, but I don't think it's atypical. I think that there's actually probably more variation in things that look like they're standardized than we actually think there are, than there is at first glance.
Well, I think you're right about yeah. there being variation of things that look like they're standardized, but
yeah.
I think a lot of that is that the things that look like they're standardized and aren't quite – when you say that things are the same,
yes.
you don't mean that they're absolutely identical.
Right.
What you mean is that for the purposes at hand,
yeah.
they are the same.
Yeah.
And lots of things are sufficiently standardized that for the purposes at hand, they're the same. So if I go to the supermarket and buy a quart of milk, I don't spend a lot of time looking at the various milk containers of that brand of milk that I'm buying. I just pick one off the shelf. And if the milk doesn't start to pour out of the bottom of it because somebody broke it,
right.
I stick it in my shopping cart and move on.
Right.
Okay? And if you look carefully, of course, you might find that the label on one is on slightly crooked, and that one of them is slightly more filled to the top than the other one is, and so on. But those are meaningless distinctions for purposes of talking about whether something is the same in that context.
Right.
But I get, I mean, I think there is an issue about, I mean, the price differences, right? So the price of a gallon of milk is in fact not the same at Costco as it is in your neighborhood bodega, right? So even determining the price of something like milk, is not as easy as it might look, I think.
We know that if it's the price of, say, grade A whole milk, which is most of the whole milk that's sold, we know at least what we're comparing there. The price is, the comparison is a price comparison.
Right.
Yeah.
So the last historical phase is sort of our contemporary present, which you talk about, as I think quite rightly, the triumph of neoliberalism. And what's distinctive about it from the point of view of standards?
Okay. Well, the neoliberal regime under which we currently live was developed by people like F.A. Hayek and Milton Friedman and their followers.
Yeah.
And we don't need to go into the details of how that occurred. Other people have written on that subject quite well. Yeah. But it seems to me that these folks had an unabiding faith in the market. And at the same time, they were convinced that the older, laissez-faire approach to the market, the kind taken by economists in the 19th century, was inadequate in the face of communism, Nazism, and other authoritarian regimes. So they made the argument that government should not merely leave markets alone, but that governments should be redesigned to promote markets, to turn everything into markets or market-like institutions. Mm-hmm. Now, what they ignored, and I think we're utterly oblivious to, mm-hmm. is that governance is mm-hmm. inevitable. Mm-hmm. And that is to say, since we're neither autonomous individuals nor fully socialized beings, that is to say, on the one hand, we don't act in an entirely individual manner, and on the other hand, we're not like bees, which are essentially fully socialized. Mm-hmm. If given the right chemical signals, they all do the same things. So governance, as a result of that, is inescapable. And if governments don't govern, then others will. So if the government doesn't make adequate regulations, then corporations, among others, will be happy to step in and make standards that are imposed on suppliers, on workers, and on consumers. And a good example of this is the event that led to the financial crisis. Here you had financial institutions which were rather weakly regulated. The regulations that had been in place from the Roosevelt era were gradually removed. And as a result, all sorts of financial instruments, highly standardized financial instruments, were developed that proved, for all practical purposes, bogus. Now, to put this slightly differently, think of it this way. You can say then that the recent explosion of standards is in large part the result of the failure of neoliberals to understand that a reduction in the size and scope of government merely gives others who are less accountable greater control over our lives. Furthermore, markets only exist when they're allowed to exist by virtue of laws. Mm-hmm. Corporate law, anti-fraud law, contract law, intellectual property law, and so on. Without those laws, markets are essentially impossible to make and to enforce. You have to have those laws. So in a certain sense, the very distinction at the heart of neoliberalism between state and market is a false one.
Or I guess a misplaced one. So your characterization of this is the tripartite regime, I think, that blossoms mm-hmm. under neoliberalism. Although it has older roots. I think in the United States is particularly experimental in this, just in the sense, and it's particularly in like the looking at the financial crisis of 2008, right? If we think about the role of the ratings agencies and the AAA rating that they gave to all of these financial devices, those were not, I mean, it's interesting that the United States never assumed a federal role and left it to these supposedly, you know, independent free market agencies to do that. But also that there haven't really been any consequences for this system of accreditation, given since apparently the clear failure of them in 2008, right?
Absolutely. I think in a certain sense it's sort of astonishing. But yes, one of the things that I argue in the book there, and I must say the term tripartite standards regime was developed by my colleague John Stone, not by me.
Okay.
But the argument I make is that basically we have three parts to this. You have the creation of lots and lots of standards development organizations,
mm-hmm.
lots and lots of accreditation agencies who accredit certifiers, and lots of certifiers who accredit, who certify companies, or individuals as having met certain requirements that are embedded in the standards.
Yeah.
This, if you wish, is a kind of shadow government, not in the sense that's typically understood, say, in the British political system, but a shadow government in the sense that this creates a kind of worldwide governmental body mm-hmm. that's outside the sphere of government.
Yeah, official government.
That's right.
Accountable government.
It's not completely unaccountable, and again, it relies on the existence of all these legal frameworks.
Yeah.
Without that, it couldn't exist.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it seems to me that it's fraught with various kinds of conflicts of interest. One of the most recent examples is one which you may have heard about, which has been at least discussed in the U.S. press, much more so in Europe, was this scandal having to do with breast implants. And here we had a French company, I forgot the name of it off the top of my head, but a French company that was using industrial-grade silicon instead of medical-grade silicon to make these breast implants.
Okay.
And it was certified as meeting all the necessary requirements by a private certifier who it paid to certify it. And this is the crux of the issue. Just as the banks' financial situation was certified by accounting firms that were paid by the banks to certify them, so this company was certified to be producing breast implants to the proper standards.
Right.
And you could see this in food industry, you see this in the medical sector, you see this across the board of instances in which the income that certifiers derive is from the people who they certify. And hence there is a built-in conflict of interest in the system of governance that says if you don't certify these folks, you're going to lose them as a client.
Yeah. Are you still there?
Yeah.
Okay, sorry.
You cut that out.
It's okay. We're running out of time, but I want to let people know that actually the latter part of the book is a really clear and I think interesting engagement with the politics of this and with the ethics of the standardization regime. Since we have taken up so much of your time, though, why don't you just tell us what you're working on now?
Okay. Currently, I'm pursuing this interest in in neoliberalism, and I'm trying to look at neoliberalism not in the way that many other of my colleagues look at it, that is to say as a reigning ideology, but to look at neoliberalism as simultaneously a kind of economic science and a set of normative prescriptions as to how society should look.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm currently writing a volume. It's tentatively titled Real Myths, False Truths. And it takes off from the line in Foucault that I actually cite at the beginning of the Standards book. And that line is Foucault's notion that he wants to show how a particular regime of truth and therefore not an error makes something that does not exist able to become something. That is to say, what's fascinating about neoliberalism to me is how it started with a set of philosophical and theoretical arguments
mm-hmm.
backed up actually by not terribly much on the empirical side,
yeah.
but a tremendous amount of, shall we say, deep thinking.
Uh-huh.
And it then managed over a period of about 30 years, its practitioners managed to make it into a reality.
Yeah.
And what I want to do is to produce this volume in a way that it's accessible to the general public.
Right.
Not just to the science studies community.
Right.
But looks at how, for example, how the concept of the market works beautifully in introductory economics textbooks, but completely falls apart when you actually look at individual markets. So if you compare, say, the farmer's market to the stock market to the real estate market, you quickly realize that the frames in which these markets operate are radically different.
Right.
And the nature of the transactions are radically different. And I want to go through all of these myths, many of which, not all of which, many of which are of neoliberal origin, and show how they become real in the sense that we've come to believe them and to act accordingly, but that in fact they are false truths.
No, that sounds fascinating, and I think sorely needed to have more sophistication about our economic thinking. And I like the way that you're sort of bringing together the natural and the normative in the same way that you did in this book. Sounds vaguely horrifying that you could just sort of create a whole world of neoliberalism, actually, to tell you the truth. Thanks very much, Larry. That was my conversation with Larry Bush, the author of Standards, Recipes for Reality. As I mentioned in the interview, there's a lot more in the book that we didn't get to talk about. Bush talks about the sources of normativity, the political implications of standards, and he assesses attempts to standardize political decision-making through things like cost-benefit analysis and risk assessments. Thanks for listening. I'm Patrick Slaney for the New Books Network Science, Technology, and Society page.